right relationship to the wild, to wild nature, both without and within ourselves, is essential to the Earth's flourishing and ours. In their several ways, our panelists have been articulating and striving for such right relationship throughout their works and days. And it's an honor and extraordinary thing to be among them and as part of all this gathering today. Our first speaker is David Ehrenfeld, a distinguished professor of biology at Rutgers University. Ehrenfeld is a prolific author whose books include The Arrogance of Humanism, which was kind of earth-shattering in its moment or consciousness-raising in its moment and still holds up. And his current book is Becoming Good Ancestors, How We Balance Nature, Community, and Technology. Ehrenfeld edited the journal, or helped launch the journal Conservation Biology, and helped shape that discipline. He's a lifelong conservationist whose concern and scholarship were deeply influenced by early encounters with sea turtles. So let's welcome David Ehrenfeld.
Thank you, Stephanie. Introduction. Also want to thank Jerry Mander for having organized and brought this all together and the various people who've helped him. But I do have one bone to pick with Jerry. The first fax was not sent in the 20th century. The first fax was sent in 1864 between Paris and Lyon, and it was electrochemically based. It worked beautifully. Faxes were sent in the First World War, but then for some reason people decided they didn't really need fax, so it faded away. And now it's back. Maybe people had more judgment in those days. I don't know. I want to talk about, like everybody else here, about technology. And as I see it, there's two problems with technology. One is that it damages people and damages the Earth. The other problem, which is the one I want to talk about, is that it doesn't work very well. There's a tremendous exaggeration of the power of technology that all of us are subject to. We hear this day and night from advertising, which we've heard before, and many sources. So let me begin. In 1971, Eugene Schwartz, a senior scientist specializing in computer and information science at the Illinois Institute of Technology Research Institute in Chicago, wrote a critically important and now nearly forgotten book called Overskill, The Decline of Technology in Modern Civilization. That was a pretty bold subtitle for 1971, The Decline of Technology in Modern Civilization. The LA Times at the time described the book as possibly, quote, the most frightening book of the 20th century because it does not allow us the ultimate illusion that science and technology are capable of rescuing us from what Schwartz describes as the excesses of technological civilization which threaten all present and future life on Earth. Now, Schwartz devoted much of his book to explaining why technological solutions to our problems are never complete, why they generate residue problems, as he called them, each of which is likely to be more expensive and more difficult to resolve than the original problem. So technology is great at solving its problems in a way that generates more problems that are more expensive than they ever were before. In my book, The Arrogance of Humanism, published a few years after Overskill, I expanded on some of Schwartz's themes and came to very similar conclusions. Discussions of the future by modern advocates of technology invariably start with the illusion, and it is an illusion, that if anything is broken or wanting, science and technology can fix it. As James Kunstler said in The Long Emergency, how could a nation that put men on the moon feel anything but a nearly godlike confidence in its ability to overcome difficulties? Men on the moon, MRIs, whatever. TV ads say, if you want your children to be little Einsteins, and we've heard before about this today, let them watch our copyrighted DVD and they'll become little Einsteins. What they don't say is that your kids may turn out to be dumber than children who watch less TV. And that's been pretty well shown, even in court. Biotech seed companies say if you want your crops to grow in a California drought, plant our genetically engineered drought-resistant seeds. What they don't say is that those GE seeds don't do as well in droughts as some conventionally bred crops that farmers have been using for years. But they don't do nearly as well. The worship of technology is a true religion. You can't argue with the believers. Don't try it. Well, try it maybe, but it won't help. They live in a fantasy future of their own making, supported by well-funded technology salesmen who are clandestinely subsidized out of our own pockets. Half a century ago, when fusion energy was promoted as a solution to all our energy problems, we were told that it would be developed in 40 years. That was about a half century ago. About a year ago, I listened to a fusion scientist, a very well-known fusion scientist from Princeton's Fusion Laboratory, talk about the exciting new technologies in fusion power. How long will it take them to develop them, somebody asked. About 40 years, she answered. I love that. For the techno-utopians, success is a moving target. As Wendell Berry put it in The Unsettling of America, the technology worshippers live in a future that is, quote, both threat and lure, the secular hell and heaven of the enraptured booster, end quote. Eventually, but not soon enough, I'm afraid they'll have to come down to earth. And some of them are coming down to earth already. Then, as Berry wrote, let them eat the future. One of his best lines. In other talks at this meeting, you may hear why genetic engineering of crop plants will not end hunger, in fact, make it worse eventually, and why geoengineering manipulation of our atmosphere is not going to end dangerous climate change. I'm going to be explaining why genetic engineering in the form of de-extinction, a word as clumsy as it is presumptuous, and I apologize for even using it, will not bring back healthy flocks of passenger pigeons and herds of woolly mammoths. Don't hold your breath. See a flock of passenger pigeons flying overhead. I'm going to concentrate on the poster child for de-extinction, the passenger pigeon. All the other candidates for de-extinction have their own, often similar problems, but this is a good place to start, because this has gotten the most press. The first European visitors to North America noted huge flocks of passenger pigeons, which darkened the skies from horizon to horizon, as far as you could see in any direction, for several days as they flew past at 60 miles per hour. Imagine a flock of birds darkening the sky for several days from horizon to horizon. Even in the 19th century, when the pigeons were starting to decline, different observers estimated over 1 billion birds in some flocks. That's a lot of birds. A market hunter with a shotgun could close his eyes, point it up in the air, fire it, and bring down many pigeons with a single shot, maybe 50 or more. Properly placed nets could yield hundreds of birds in a very short time, a matter of minutes. When the pigeons roosted in a beech or chestnut forest, the combined weight of the birds would bring down giant tree limbs with a sound like cannon fire. Yet the last passenger pigeon on Earth, named Martha, died in the Cincinnati Zoo in September of 1914, just about 100 years ago. What happened to them all? The easiest answer is that it was partly a combination of forest loss to increasing agriculture and market hunting. There's not much market hunting around these days, but it was a big thing in the 19th and early 20th centuries. But here's the question I think we should ask before we try to pretend we can bring passenger pigeons back. In the late 1800s, there were still thousands of pigeons left. Maybe not billions, but thousands. Some in flocks in protected areas. Why didn't any of these populations rebound? They all went on to become extinct. There were thousands of them. A likely answer that has most people think of, scientists who think about this, think about, is that the birds which laid only one egg each needed many thousands of other pigeons around them to stimulate proper mating and nesting and to overwhelm their predators. This is a well-known phenomenon. Biologists call it the Ali effect, originally described by a biologist named W. Clyde Ali back in the 30s. Ali noticed that if he put one goldfish in a tank and measured its growth rate, he would find out what it was. But if he put a bunch of goldfish in the same tank, they all grew faster. That's the Ali effect. So the de-extinction experts are going to try to revive what may be the most social bird in North American history, maybe in any history, and at great cost will bring back one of them, maybe even 50. And think ahead of time about what will happen if you do revive an extinct organism. Will it fall victim to predators, parasites, and diseases? Will it have any habitat to live in? Chestnuts were one of the pigeons' favorite foods, but the chestnut forests are gone, at least in North America, are gone. They loved acorns, but the oak forests are in decline from the sudden oak decline. Pigeons, which had a prodigious appetite, they could swallow so many acorns at one sitting to expand their crop out to enormous size, might they become a destructive invasive species if we brought them back, eating crops? Here's a related problem which applies to passenger pigeons and many of the proposed de-extinction candidates, such as the woolly mammoth, the thylacine, which is the Tasmanian tiger, or some people call the Tasmanian wolf, and the Carolina parakeet. Who's going to give birth to and mother a passenger pigeon, for example, or a baby mammoth? An elephant? Passenger pigeon? Who's going to mother that? A mourning dove, a rock dove, or a common pigeon, or a band-tailed pigeon? These are the candidates that have been suggested. They still exist. Observations made in the 19th century showed that passenger pigeon chicks reared by mourning doves would mate only with other mourning doves, not with passenger pigeons. This fits in very nicely with some of the comments made a little bit earlier about the importance of mothering. We also know that these foster parent species, elephants, band-tailed pigeons, behave very differently than passenger pigeons did. Not the elephants, of course. They never had anything to do with passenger pigeons. But the band-tailed pigeons fly differently than the passenger pigeons did. They mate differently. They eat different foods. They have different calls. Maternal care, as we learn every year, is critical, more and more every year, is critically important for an infant's normal development. That baby passenger pigeon may live in a cage labeled passenger pigeon, but it may not be like a real passenger pigeon, and it certainly isn't going to bring passenger pigeons back from extinction. True, there are animals that don't have the endangered species or extinct species that don't have maternal care, like most fish, amphibians, and reptiles. They wouldn't present this difficulty, but they have plenty of other challenges to overcome. Now, the next problem is a genetic problem. In the first college course I took in molecular biology, and I was educated long enough ago that there was only one course in molecular biology in my college at that time, which I was lucky enough to have taught by a visiting English scientist, Francis Crick, we learned that DNA is a book of instructions which tells how to make a specific organism. DNA makes RNA makes protein. That was the mantra. And the DNA code is the same for just about every organism. Wow, I can still feel the excitement that idea generated. And we all talked about it, and it was the most exciting scientific fact and discovery of that part of the 20th century, maybe any part of the 20th century. But here we are a half century later, and we now know that things are not so simple. A gene, a DNA strand, doesn't tell you how to read it and make an organism. There's no part of the DNA strand that tells you how to operate it, how to make an organism from it. People don't realize this. We hear so much about DNA, and it makes me ill sometimes to hear the amazing misconceptions in the popular mind about DNA. A DNA strand is more like a database, like a dictionary. More like that than a book of instructions. All the words in Hamlet are in my dictionary, but if I shake my dictionary, Hamlet does not fall out of it, for reasons I've never been able to understand. The emerging science of epigenetics, which I think is the most exciting development in molecular biology in recent years, tells us that a single strand of DNA can be read in hundreds, maybe thousands of different ways. It's the other molecules, the proteins, the non-coding RNAs in that first egg cell, which tell the cell what parts of the DNA to read, what order to read these parts in, and what parts of the DNA to skip altogether, maybe until another phase of development. The internal and external environments of the egg cell, female egg cell, tell the cell how to use the DNA to make an organism. That's why genetically identical clones of plants and identical twins of animals, which have the same DNA, can be quite different when grown in different environments. With de-extinction, the epigenetic departures from the expected are likely to be even more extreme than in the clone plants or identical twins, because, for example, epigenetic factors in the egg cell of a band-tailed pigeon that contains inserted passenger pigeon DNA in an effort at de-extinction will be different from the epigenetic components of the cells of an original passenger pigeon mother, now gone. And it's unlikely we can ever recover those instructions on how to read their DNA. How the passenger pigeon's DNA will be read by the band-tailed pigeon's egg cell is anybody's guess. I described this problem to a molecular biologist friend of mine, and he had a clever suggestion for the de-extinction scientists, which I'm sure they will ignore. Take two clearly different but very closely related living species. Pretend one of them is extinct, put its DNA into the egg of the other species. When you get a viable organism, you can see how well it matches the DNA donor. There'll be plenty of living examples to compare it to. If the animal you get from, a black rat DNA inserted into a brown rat mother behaves and looks like a black rat, well, then it's worked. But my guess is it won't work very well. Finally, there are two other problems that have been mentioned many times, so I'll only briefly discuss them. First, de-extinction would only target a very few species and is extremely expensive. Will it divert conservation dollars from tried and true conservation measures that already work, we know they work, and which are always short of funds? Strategies such as protected areas, parks, nature reserves, genetic management of small remnant populations, and public campaigns to reduce consumption of endangered species. These are all examples of things that work. At this very moment, brave conservationists are risking their lives to protect dwindling groups of the remaining African forest elephants from heavily armed poachers. And here we are in this nice, safe auditorium talking about bringing back the woolly mammoth. Second is the problem of patenting. Although the Supreme Court has restricted the patenting of DNA, this is a limited restriction and is unlikely to apply to de-extinction. Would the genetically engineered passenger pigeon be patented by the lab that brings it back? Could be. Genetic engineers love to patent their products. If so, any future flocks of wild passenger pigeons will be owned by the patent holder. A more likely example, one which people are already worrying about, is the American chestnut, which is not completely extinct, but mostly. There are a number of groups and individuals trying to bring back a blight-resistant American chestnut, some by conventional breeding, some by genetic engineering. Both approaches have promise, and I wish them luck. But the idea of all the revived chestnuts in North America, both planted and wild, being owned, for example, by Monsanto, is not a pleasant thought. If you're interested in the chestnut, I recommend Susan Frankel's wonderful book, American Chestnut, The Life, Death, and Rebirth of a Perfect Tree. So in conclusion, the conservation movement has based much of its appeal on the power of the statement that extinction is forever, which is true. It would be a tragedy if the technology-worshipping public is led to believe that extinction is only temporary, a technological bump on the road, nothing to worry about. De-extinction is an appealing idea, a kind of recreational conservation game, but in any meaningful sense, it's only a game. with many of what Eugene Schwartz would have called residue problems. Thank you.
Our next speaker is, like David Ehrenfeld, an existentially committed conservationist. Doug Tompkins is a wilderness advocate, a mountaineer, and founder of the Foundation for Deep Ecology, which has supported a tremendous amount of visionary work in exploring a different paradigm for our relation to nature. He is the founder of the Conservation Land Trust and Conservación Patagónica, and the author of, just lately, 180 Degrees South, Conquerors of the Useless. Let's welcome Doug Tompkins.
Just to give you a little bit of atmosphere, you'll be seeing a sort of a continuous reel of photographs that are self-explanatory in general, although they have some big headings. And this is just to kind of put the context on a few of the remarks I'm going to make, and of course many people have been making during the course of these 2 days. And I just want you to just sort of let them go by, and maybe it'll kind of sink in that what we're seeing here is the consequence of the techno-industrial culture that we're immersed in, a system that's wrecking the world. The reason why we have conservation movement, why we have an environmental movement. And it's taking lots of forms, and it's accelerating. So just kind of let those things cruise through your mind. And as Jerry said, images, once they go in, they stay in there. So I hope that will kind of help sensitize ourselves to this. We use these kind of images. Some of you may be familiar with the books that our foundation publishes. Tom Butler, who you heard a little bit earlier, was speaking about the most recent book on overdevelopment, overpopulation, and overshoot that'll be out shortly. I noticed there are a few books out on the stands out there. One of the recent ones was a book on energy that we did in cooperation with Post Carbon Institute. They're activist books aimed at what we call, and I'll touch on it in a little bit, the building of the intellectual infrastructure that's necessary to get a systemic analysis in the minds of activists, first and foremost, and then to widen that circle out to the leadership, which might, you know, be the political leadership or the press or the professional side of society. They're 2 or 3% of society usually takes the rest of society with it. I call that 2 or 3% the leadership. And those are the ones that, as activists, I think we have to activate and to push the bar up on their understanding, a deep systemic analysis of the issues that are in front of us. To start out, I'd like to talk about the current and, to me, one of the most potent weapons of mass destruction, the cell phone. And I propose, because I'm sure that I'm talking to literally a room of 100% socially responsible activist types, that we should take that cell phone. And I'm also assuming that the majority of you might have them, although we are in a group here, which I've already talked to some people that don't have cell phones. But in any case, whether it's yours or somebody you know, in your family, friends, associates, anywhere, take that cell phone and make a little experiment. It takes a month to do it, but it takes 5 seconds every day. 10 seconds. I want 10 seconds every day. And take that thing and just hold it out there in front of you and look at it and let your mind go back through all the processes that you can imagine that it took get that cell phone in your hand, that little apparatus, that little device in your hand, and there you'll see what I think Wes Jackson invented the term. You will see the scaffolding of civilization that holds up the manufacture. Let's not even discuss the use of this thing yet. The manufacture of that little device. We have the mining, we have the refining, we have the machines that do the mining, we have the machines that make the machines that do the mining, we have the transporting systems, we have the houses that the machine operators live in, we have the roads that they travel on and on and on. And that is the thing that's producing what you're seeing up here on the screen. And this is the techno-industrial culture, which I don't know a better word for it than that, but it is destroying the world. So it seems logical, it seems prudent, it seems intelligent that we make a deep systemic analysis of how this got to be, and that the development trajectory, the notion of progress, is tied in to that idea of forth that brings us today to the so-called information revolution that's taking place and is manifested in this little small portable, highly accelerating device called the cell phone, which is a little computer you carry around with you. And of course, it's got other negative side effects we know about. It's produced a narcissistic society that everybody's taking pictures of themselves with the thing. But leaving those kind of trivial things aside, its main function is to accelerate the transfer of living nature to that of the realm of production, basically. That's what it does the best. And when it was being invented, really, as an outgrowth and now a miniaturization of the PC, the personal computer, I was living in San Francisco in those days, was friends with Steve Jobs. And we used to talk about this. And of course, here he was promoting this. This was the road to paradise. This was the techno-utopia. And he'd get real huffy with me when I told him that it was going to do nothing but destroy the world. And he came out with this fantastic advertising campaign. You may remember it. It was splashed across every single print media you could see. And it was telling you about the 1,000 wonderful things that technology was going to bring. And of course, like all messiahs, these were all good things. But in our conversation sitting around at my house in San Francisco late at night, I kept getting on his case about how come all those 1,000 things that nobody could argue with only added up to 5% of what this magical device did. The other 95% of it was all negative. It was the conversion of nature to the realm of production, and it was accelerating this process. So this got me at that time, this is almost 30 years ago, thinking deeply about the question of technology. And I think, and my advice, for what it's worth, and of course we have a room full of people who have been thinking deeply about this, but for many of us, even close colleagues, we have to learn from each other, and we have to build this intellectual infrastructure in our heads to be able to make a real solid systemic analysis. And that these technologies are not neutral, that they have inherent logic. I hope we'll hear some more from Langdon Winner, who's really developed this idea and who's one of my mentors in this line of thinking. That when a society adopts any given technology, it's going to be obliged to behave according to the dictates of that technology. This is a sort of a critical, I think, linchpin in the arguments of this systemic analysis. Once we get that, we can start to put up an adequate filter about the kind of technologies that we allow into the culture. And until we get that, I don't think you can really see it. And I think once you do that, you will start to roll the clock back, so to speak, and unroll many of these technologies, these mega technologies, because they have to have, just like that cell phone, they have to have the whole scaffolding of civilization to hold them up. And it's the scaffolding and the existence of the scaffolding that becomes the problem. And we can't escape that. It's obliging us to build a techno-industrial culture. And that techno-industrial culture, we can go through the worldview that is built on, the mechanistic worldview. We already heard some of that earlier from Charlene. But we're using the wrong model. We're using the machine as model rather than nature as model. And once again, Wes, who's just sitting here off to my right, will tell you about nature as measure in much greater detail. But if we're using nature as the model or we're using the machine as the model, I find is one of the watersheds upon which we're able to reframe a worldview that could possibly, with no guarantees, give a rapprochement with nature and human societies. So I take that if we used as I don't know exactly what Wes is going to be saying, but I've been listening to Wes for 20-some years, so I have a general idea what he'll be talking about. But I suggest that we use biodiversity as the metric, biodiversity health as the metric, the overall metric, the replacement of the GNP or even well-being indicators to see how the human project is faring. That if we use biodiversity, because if we continue the extinction crisis, the mother of all crises, to its logical conclusion, and if humanity would somehow magically survive that, we'll be sitting on a sand dune with cockroaches and a few Norwegian rats, and that'll be the end of it. So I use biodiversity as the measure. And if we're not slowing down now and reversing the extinction crisis, everything else is irrelevant. Social justice is laudable as it is, important, needs to be a half step behind and on the shoulder of biodiversity conservation and the ending of the extinction crisis. Because if we can solve the extinction crisis, most all other problems will start to fall in line or be within reach of solving. It will not guarantee an equitable society. I understand that. That will have to be worked on by itself. But there will be no social justice, as they say, on a dead planet. So we have to put it half a step behind biodiversity conservation. I see that that's resonating with some of you. And that's not to, for a second, to undermine social justice efforts. Those have to be going on simultaneously. But I think it would be good that we green the reds and the reds green. The greens get redder. So, an ethical stance. I think that we haven't talked too much about ethics so far, but I think that this is the thing that informs our own individual behavior. And again, if biodiversity is the metric, I think that sharing the planet with other creatures is the phrase, perhaps, that best articulates my sense of how we can find an ethical stance. And again, if we take that seriously and we believe in that and we work towards that, even immersed in a techno-industrial system that we're trying to transition out of or would like to transition out of, we will have a good ethical position. And that will filter back literally into everything that we do. From an activist standpoint, another point that I think is worth making is that there's a tendency, a strong tendency, for us to jump to action, to jump to strategies. And I just caution our fellow activists to spend more time on the substantive, systemic, deep systemic analysis of the issues that we're working on. Again, that's one of the reasons that for the books that we do. The last point is that of hope. Every day we're getting negative and depressing news. We see it right and left, especially if we're in the activist community. This has a demotivating and a enervating impact on us. I just wanted to point out that all of you, in whatever part of the social movement you see yourself, you're in an unstoppable movement, be it the peace movement, the feminist movement, social justice movement, the conservation environmental movement. These are unstoppable movements. If we take a look at the modern environmental movement started, they say, in 1962 with Rachel Carson's book, and it's just been expanding out and out and out since that time. And I don't see any signs that it's flagging. It, of course, is responding to a bigger and bigger crisis, but it's unstoppable. Can it stop and reverse the crisis that we're in? That I don't know. We'll have to see. In any case, to finish up, I'd just like to read a poem that will be helpful maybe to give us some vision. And this is a poem that was written 2,700 years ago, but it seems to fit what we need to be thinking about today. Better to keep your country small, your people few, your devices simple, and even those for infrequent use. Let people measure life by the meaning of death and not go out of their way to visit far-off places with nowhere to travel and little care for display of great ships and shining weapons become mere relics of the past. Let people recover the simple life, reckoning by knotted cords, delighted in a basic meal, pleased with humble attire, happy in their homes, taking pleasure in their rustic ways. So content are they that nearby towns so close the sound of dogs and roosters forms one chorus, folks grown gray with age may pass away never having strayed beyond the village. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Doug. We are approaching the Tao of the fate of the earth, perhaps, in this gathering, learning about the importance of considering things not in isolation, but as part of a fabric of life. Our next speaker, Mary Reynolds Thompson, will help us consider the wild within and its power to reintegrate us with the cause of life. She is the founder of Live Your Wild Soul Story. She's a facilitator of journal and poetry workshops, writing and eco-spirituality retreats, all aiming at helping participants to reconnect with the wild within. She is the author of Embrace Your Inner Wild, 52 Reflections for an Ecocentric World, and Reclaiming Your Wild Soul, How Earth's Landscapes Restore Us to Wholeness. Please welcome the wild soul lady, Mary Reynolds Thompson.
My husband and I have spent quite a bit of time backpacking in the mountains. It's hard at first. You're weighed down with so much, you feel as if you will fall backwards. But you learn to adapt to the rhythm and the incline of the mountain. Learn an old mountain technique, the rest step, rest, step, rest. The mountains rise above you, ancient, abiding, monumental, bringing you into a deep time perspective. While the weight you carry is 30 pounds or more, you are also shedding, anxieties, petty concerns. Did I send that email? Is so-and-so still mad at me? These tiny thoughts now dwarfed by the grandeur of Granite Peaks. As dusk descends, you hear bears rooting beyond the campsite. You have seen their scat, and the hairs on the back of your neck bristle. You are not the top of the food chain here. The next morning, high on an escarpment, you spy two grizzlies, their muscled humps visible even from a distance. You go to pee, and you look up at a black bear sprawled in the branches just above your head. Each day, your muscles harden with the work and the walking. The backpack is now a part of you. You learn the language of thunderclouds, filter water from ice-cold streams, push, pull, push. Between you both, a rhythm. You find easily the parts you play, work together, often in silence, but gracefully, aware of each other. The steep bowl of the mountain cradles you, brings you closer together. Nightfall and the dreams come. Away from technology, they pulse with wildness. You are riding a great white bear into the heavens, the night a black flower, its stamen an outpouring of stars. With sunrise, your dreams are dreams of the earth, rooted, fecund with desire for meaning, aliveness. Then the descent. The car awaits, you turn on the news, catastrophes abound. You crave a cappuccino from Starbucks, return home to thousands of emails, the stresses and distractions. Did you manage to record Mad Men, Game of Thrones? How will you juggle it all? The demands pile up. The mountains recede, but not quite. For even amid the bustle, something wild and ancient and primal abides, slumbering, but still there. What I want to talk to you about, What I want to talk to you about today is that essentially we're not the same people when we're connected to nature and the natural world that we are when we're caught up in the whirl of technology, this hyper-tech, hyper-past, sped-up world that is the modern world that we live in. That in this, we are actually changing our nature too. And that inner and outer nature are equally affected by this process of modernism. When we tame the natural world, we also tame ourselves. If we really understand that in a sense we humans are just the earth in human form, we really do get that what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. The writer Lawrence Durrell said, "Each landscape asks the same question. I am watching myself in you. Are you watching yourself in me?" And what I think he was saying is that in the landscapes around us, there's a mirroring. So when we are exposed to beautiful places, we feel this incredible sense of awe and grandeur and perhaps possibility that rises up in us. But what happens when we look out at desecrated, despoiled landscapes? What does that tell us about who we are? You know, I think this mirroring is not abstract. I think it's very particular. I think, and we've been seeing these unbelievable images of what we're doing to the world up on the screen today. But if we look at something like mountaintop removal, the willingness to destroy entire ancient mountains just to extract the ore from them, isn't that what we do with human beings too? We just want what they can offer to the GDP and to hell with their totality. You know, if we can't be with mystery and darkness and shadow, then God help the forests. And if we think, like somebody was saying earlier, that it has to be about what we have and not who we be, then is it ever, why do we even wonder why in a landscape like the desert, we pour all of our toxins and we blow up bombs and atomic bombs and we, you know, desecrate what we deem wastelands because it's not productive. The parallels are very, very specific. Now, we saw earlier today, you know, there's this view that humans are the very top, we're brilliant, you know, or we're absolute shits, right? And we're doing all this stuff because we're no good. Well, I want to offer a third option, is that we're doing it because we're wounded. We are deeply wounded. When you think about it, we humans lived in close harmony with the earth for most of human history. Our sense of nature was such that it gave us our sense of the divine, it helped create cultures, it created our cosmologies. And then, in a sort of rapid, some people have talked today about, you know, with the onslaught of agriculture, but more and more, more deeply, sped up, quicker and quicker, we have been wrenched from the earth. Now, if you do that to a people, you leave a void, and nature abhors a vacuum. So what comes into this void, this spiritual loss that we have, this sense of meaning that's been wrenched from us as we've been taken from the earth? Okay, let's have more stuff, let's consume more, give me another tech toy, give me, fill me up. You know, you can go to any 12-step meeting anywhere in the world, and I've been to a good few of them, and you will hear this over and over again. There was a black hole inside of me, and I needed to fill it. And when you have a hole inside of you, you don't ask, is that pill good for me? You don't ask, is this going to be all right? Will there be side effects? You just say, give it to me. So I would say that we have to understand that separating from nature has caused such a deep wound in us. Unless we own that and see it, we're missing a big part of the equation here. Thank you. Thank you. You mentioned the wonderful cultural historian Thomas Berry and his quote about if we had arisen from the moon. And I think that that's a very interesting statement to repeat. Really what Stephanie was saying is that he said, imagine if humans had been born and raised and grew up on the moon, imagine how desolate our creativity would be. Imagine what our sense of the divine would be. Imagine who we would be, what our thoughts would be, you know, arising from that tremendous sense of desolation. Well, as we can see, we are creating moonscapes everywhere. And this is a kind of a feedback loop, right? So the more desolation we create, the more our creations arise out of that desolate landscape. And you know, we weren't meant to create from that place. We emerged into our human consciousness during the Cenozoic period, the greatest burgeoning, most fecund, fertile time. And we awoke to color and smell and fragrance and insects and flowers. But now look at where our creativity is coming from. The more moonscape we create, the more desolate our technologies, the more desolate our imaginations will become. But we can also create a virtual cycle. The more wildness we reclaim, the more access to wildness we have within, the more fecund and fertile and ecological our thinking can become. Because right now, we're creating out of a very lonely, small, isolated, egoic soul. And what we really want to be is creating out of the love and confidence and caring from seeing ourselves as ecological beings. My husband and I were in the Rocky Mountains, and he heard this hawk cry, and he was mesmerized. We were sort of doing a vision questy kind of thing, and so, right, messages from the hawk. So he was following this hawk noise out further and further, and the next thing you knew, a goshawk, 5-foot wingspan, was swooping down on him, talons bare, shk, 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 like this over and over again, because she was protecting her nest. You know, that's the kind of wild fierceness we want. You know, this isn't the attack of destruction, it's the no of protection. No, you don't hurt my nest. No, you don't hurt my children. No, you don't hurt my land. No, no, no. Now, some of us might be saying, well, I don't get to go out into the mountains so much. Now, I don't have time, or I live in a city, or I, you know, the opportunities, I'm physically not able to be able to go out for a long walk or anything like that. So what I want to say to each of you is it doesn't take much. You know, I like to say, greet each leaf you meet. Look at a sliver of sky. When you take a breath, remember where it comes from. It doesn't have to be much. The other thing is that nature is in us. The earth is in us. We don't have to just search it out there. We just have to realize that the earth is within us. And so often I think we abdicate our responsibility by saying, well, indigenous people get the connection to the earth. But we're all indigenous people. At one point, we were all indigenous people. And this is much older in us. And you know, nature doesn't like to discard, it builds upon. So just because we are modern humans does not mean that that ancient primal wisdom isn't in us if we listen to it. So I would like to end with just a very short 3-minute, what is it? It's a kind of visual meditation, which is really an invitation for all of you to just sit back, relax, and feel into the ancient earth consciousness that lives within you. Thank you.
recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, and he's a MacArthur Fellow. And a jolly good fellow is he. He is a sodbuster who is trying to redeem agriculture. That's his plot. And he's a prolific author. Recent book is titled Consulting the Genius of Place, An Ecological Approach to a New Agriculture. Earlier books and with evocative titles that fit right in with our theme today, Becoming Native to This Place, and a very early book with an extremely poetic title, Altars of Unhewn Stone, Science and the Earth. Wes Jackson, champion of the prairie and an author of hope.
Well, thank you, old friend. Does this work? No. To the organizers, thank you for making this forum possible. It's been a great time. And thanks, Doug, for your engagement and all that. The people who study human evolution are constantly thinking about, of course, our past and what has brought us to this point. And it's been said that if one were to get on a bus and there was a Neanderthal that came and sat beside you, you might change seats. If you were on a bus and there was Homo habilis, or Homo erectus, you'd probably get off the bus. These are among our ancestors. And it makes me wonder if there must be a longing to get back to that. But that's who we are. We've been part of a journey. It's part of the journey work of the stars. Because as we all know, that we living things are the late outgrowth of the metabolism of our galaxy. The carbon, which enters so importantly in our bodies, was cooked in the remote past of a dying star. And from it came nitrogen and oxygen, and these are indispensable elements were spewed out into space to mix and form planets, and eventually we ourselves. George Wald said that, and he continued, "The ancient seas set the pattern of ions in our blood, and the ancient atmospheres molded our metabolism. There's no other place for us. And we better get over the idea that there can be a new frontier." And it's wonderful that we have answered two of the three old religious questions. Where do we come from? And what kind of a thing are we? And no other species has probably done that. The third question hangs in the balance. What's to become of us? So, with that as kind of a background, we are the creature that represents matter and energy's way of having gained self-recognition. That's a big thing. But what is it then that causes us to forget that and move in such crazy directions that destroys or threatens to destroy the possibility that future generations will know that? Coming across the Bay Bridge from San Francisco to Berkeley, after a frustrating meeting as a member of the board of directors, riding with Dan Luton, who also was frustrated back in 1984-85, frustrated that we couldn't get global warming to become an issue. And about halfway across, Dan said, "You know, Wes, the problem is, we came as a poor people to a seemingly empty land that was rich in resources. And we built our institutions for that perception of reality. Poor people, empty land, rich, our educational institutions, our political institutions, our social institutions, all predicated on poor people, empty land, rich. Well, now we've become rich people in an increasingly poor land that's filling up, and those institutions don't hold. We patch them up, we give them a lick and a promise, but they don't hold. Wendell Berry said in The Unsettling of America that we came with vision, but not with sight. We came with visions of former places, but not the sight to see where we are. And as we came across the continent, cutting the forests and plowing the prairies, we've never known what we were doing, because we've never known what we were undoing. Wendell went on to say, when we got here, we found natives. And those natives became surplus people. And so we effectively institutionalized surplus peoplehood. And one of the ways we did it was to refer to the natives as redskins. And now we have more and more redskins, surplus people. The institutionalization of the manifest destiny. Well, it seems to me that this is the sort of thing that has to hang in our background. And now I'm supposed to have something so I can show some slides. And I hope this is it. I don't expect much of technology, and it's not to expect much of me. Okay. Well, that didn't do it. What? It's on the podium. Where? There's nothing here, but please speak directly into the mic. That's what's on here. I got this little deal. Well, let's try this. Oh, look at that. Here we go. All right. Now, the thing that's interesting about this creature is that that's the main group of dinosaurs that gave rise to birds. That creature has a very high or very low brain to mass ratio. But it was doing all right until 65 million years ago. And I guess the geologists are pretty confident of this, but there was an asteroid that hit down in the Yucatan that at the point of impact was as tall as Mount Everest. And they have some reason to believe, based on the crystallization, it was coming in at 50,000 miles an hour. Now, that's moving. And they went, but thankfully there were some little creatures here and there that became sort of the forerunners of us. So thank God for the extinction of the dinosaurs. And thank God that there were some primordia to give rise to birds. Because there ain't no fence that's going to hold that guy. We would not have been allowed to stay here no matter what. So for those of you that are concerned about extinction, think about it again. Now, the problem is, it was an asteroid that did it, and we now have what I'm calling astroblemes as the consequence of agriculture that is doing the same thing as that single event. It's just that it's been sprinkled out over a 10,000-year period. So, I throw this in for no extra charge. The brain to biomass ratio and the mass to energy ratio is something to think about and is part of the problem of our times. The brain to to mass and the brain to energy ratios are something that is a part of our modern problem. So here is a derivative of that extinction. The Earth is not going to quit producing. The Earth is the ecosphere is the only creative force at work in the world. It's just in time frames that we're not thinking about. So there's plenty of food now. And now I'm going to show you something where we need to get a grip. This was in National Geographic a month or two ago. And there's the list of the food, a list of some of the food that comes into New York City and places from all around the world. But if you look at that list for a single grain, you won't find it. And therein lies a problem, because land use is the number two source of greenhouse gases. 70% of our calories come from grains, occupying about some 70% of our agricultural acreage. Now, some of that land use is due to deforestation, but if you take the deforestation that's due to the extension of agriculture, then that's about equal to all transportation. So it's important that power plants are number one, land use number two, number three is transportation. Why is it that we're paying attention to squiggly light bulbs and Priuses and that type of thing? Well, because where those grains are coming is flyover country. And so I love the local, organic, community-supported agriculture, all of that. But we've got to have those folk become the core of the constituency, plus all of you here, to do something about the problem of agriculture. And I can tell you how to do that. Here is the number two crop of the United States, soybean. And here is the top carbohydrate producer of the world, corn. And those are the kinds of grains that are coming to New York, either directly or in the livestock. They're also going to make biofuels in order for us to run up and down probably one of the worst technological systems ever invented, the interstate highway system, that has led to the demise of small towns, rural communities, and so on. Here is one of the consequences of corn. This is in Iowa, in the time of the year when the rains are coming. And another consequence of that are dead zones. Nancy Rabelais, who works on the boat in the Gulf of Mexico, where the major dead zone is, as big as the state of New Jersey. Nancy Rabelais tells me, "Oh, Wes, there are 1,000 of them around the world." But what's in that upper, in that Mississippi River basin, is nitrogen. And it's the nitrogen that is the result of what's the most important invention of the 20th century. When two Germans, who knows the answer out there? Haber-Bosch. Who said that? "I want to marry you." By golly, if you can get one person that knows that in a crowd this size, that's worthy of a long-term contract. So here we... Haber-Bosch. Haber-Bosch, what?
90% of the nitrogen
Yeah. And Vaclav Smil says that if it weren't for Haber Bosch, 40% of humanity wouldn't be here today. And the feedstock for this nitrogen fertilizer is natural gas. So let's get a grip on that. Haber Bosch was 1909. But World War I, then the Depression, then World War II, and then it's about 1948. 1948 is an important year. It's 2 years after the boys have come home, as the saying goes. But then you can see that it has doubled and doubled again, and it's also about the time that we see the pesticides getting their beginning. 1962 is Rachel Carson, so those lines are about the same. So all dependent upon the extractive economy for our food supply. And here are the ammonia tanks that are all over my part of the country in Kansas. So we have all of this, and we keep needing to think about, well, what are we going to do? If 40% of humanity is dependent upon natural gas and the Haber-Bosch process, what are we going to do? Well, one possibility is to turn to nature and think about a forest, or think about a prairie, or think about an alpine meadow. And what do we find when we look at those systems? Number one, they all run on contemporary sunlight. They all feature material recycling. They all are drawing on 20-some elements that are in the upper part of the periodic chart that you see in our chemistry classrooms. And so let's consider for a moment how efficient they can be. So here's a phrase that you may take away from you. We're interested in the efficiencies inherent within natural integrities. Say it after me. Efficiencies inherent within natural integrities. Again, efficiencies inherent within natural integrities. Now, here's an example. The Haber-Bosch process happens at 400 degrees C. At 350 atmospheres of pressure, take a cubic meter of atmosphere and compress it 350 times, and it requires a catalyst. Now, I'm going to take you on one of the most fascinating journeys on planet Earth, and it's microscopic. In the prairie, primarily associated with legumes, are some bacteria that are carryovers from that period when there was no free atmospheric oxygen in the atmosphere. It's called anaerobic bacteria. But they've figured out how to do it by building a little crust around the organism, a spore, so that when that spore finds a root of a legume to land on, the root will grow around that spore, and as it's growing around that spore, it is removing the shell, we'll call it, and as it's growing, there's 78% of the atmosphere is nitrogen, so we'll call that 78%, 21% oxygen. So as it's growing, it's using up the oxygen in the growth of the plant. So now we have within that little house 4/5 of one atmosphere and using 21 enzymes, information rich. It does what Haber-Bosch does. Now, that is, we will say it together, an efficiency inherent within a natural integrity. That's just one. And there are countless of those examples that we find from natural ecosystems in what we might call nature's only true economies. There's nothing phony about those economies. They feature material recycling. They run on contemporary sunlight. All right. So here is a prairie. And in the Flint Hills of Kansas, down around a place called Matfield Green, a town without a lifestyle. Being in love is enough in Matfield Green. But here's what the ranchers do. This is what the Native Americans did. It's also what lightning did. And so we can imagine if we could build an agriculture based on the way the prairie works, that fire would be a management tool. Another management tool is grazing. And here are selective grazers. When the elk were there, they were grazing on a different photosynthetic base. Am I supposed to quit?
Yes.
All right. I better quit because...
See about compressing your catalyzation.
What?
See about compressing your catalyzation here.
You say hurry up?
Yes.
All right. So here are the way we can have cattle grazing a future prairie perennial polyculture with grains. Here is a future scene where we will be looking at the storm coming in, wondering if we will be able to get our harvest in, but knowing if we don't get the harvest in, the perennial polyculture of grains will come up next year. It will not be requiring the plow, which has destroyed more options for humanity than the sword. So, this will return someday. And here's the final picture, 1850. Imagine this world and what it was. But we all know the song about the Erie Canal, filled with lumber, coal, and hay. We know every inch of the way from Albany to Buffalo. But they had coal, and that was a foreshadow of things to come. So that's it. Sorry to go so long.